Guardian Unlimited.
I'm James Randerson, and this is Science Weekly for December the 10th. Coming up in this week's podcast, we discuss the science of nothingness with our special guest, Oxford physicist Frank Close. And if you're very lucky, we might also get him to talk about his cosmic onions too. Also in the show, science writer Mark Pilkington tells us about the aquatic ape hypothesis and other strange tales from science's outer edge. Plus, we go behind the scenes at the launch of the European Space Lab and how humans have been knocked off their cerebral pedestal by a hairy ape and why dogs always remember a familiar face. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Now, it's my third consecutive show in the hot seat, and I'm ready to make pod gold. Well, or at least bronze, anyway, who knows. Helping me out when my mind draws a blank, which is probably going to be quite often, and making a long-awaited return to the pod, it's Nell Bowes from the Guardian's arts team.
It's delightful to be here.
Well, it's good to see you too. And also, here to lend some little grey cells is science writer Mark Pilkington.
Hello, and I should let everyone know that I let some sea monkeys into the jug of water here, so...
Oh, nice. We'll come back to you both in a moment. But first, producer Ben, give me a sting. Now, in the past 18 months, we've talked about most areas of science and environment and technology on this almost award-winning show. But today, we've got nothing to talk about. Hold tight, people. Our special guest this week is Frank Close, Professor of Physics at University of Oxford and one of the UK's leading theoretical physicists, especially when it comes to the existence of empty space, or to put it another way, nothingness. Frank's latest book is called The Void, and in it he addresses some of cosmology's most fundamental questions. What lies outside the universe? And if once there was nothing, then how did the universe begin? Frank, welcome to the pod. Thanks very much for coming in. Now, you kick off the book by talking about this phrase that everyone's heard, nature abhors a vacuum, and pretty much cut that one down. Help us out with that. What are we getting wrong?
Well, it really goes back to when I was a young kid, and I used to wonder what would happen if there weren't any stars, if there wasn't the moon, there wasn't the Earth, there wasn't me, there wasn't anybody, there'd be nothing. And then I thought, but if there's nobody to know there's nothing, is there really nothing? And the more I thought about this, I thought I'll either go completely mad or I'll have true enlightenment. It was one or the other. And I gave up on it until now, with years having passed, I decided to return to try to find out what answers I could find to that. I discovered that the ancient Greeks had actually asked that question 3,000 years ago. And along the way, it turned out to be quite fascinating. Things like this famous phrase, nature abhors a vacuum. What does it mean and why? And the discovery that in the Middle Ages, the idea that you could have nothing, a vacuum, was regarded as heresy. You know, the idea that God would make nothing, you end up at the stake for saying things like that. Then people became a bit smarter and realised that the response to that was, oh, God can do whatever she likes, and if she wants to make nothing, she can make nothing. And it was Galileo who, first of all, had the idea of actually trying to do an experiment to see if you could make nothing. And that was when the scientific revolution began, and they sucked the air out of things and thought they'd made a vacuum, which in a sense they had.
But people often think of a vacuum as being able to kind of suck things together, but it's a bit different from that, isn't it?
Yes, it's a funny thing. I mean, do a little experiment yourself. If you've got a drinking straw and put your finger over one end of it and suck inwards to try and make a vacuum, what happens? The straw collapses. It doesn't want you to make a vacuum. This is the idea of nature abhors the vacuum. Put it inside a glass of juice, suck, the juice rises up to stop the vacuum appearing. And so it's very natural to think that vacuum is somehow unnatural. It can't happen. Of course, what we now know is that there's 10 tons weight of the atmosphere weighing down on every sort of square meter of the liquid and on us and on our bodies. And it is that which is forcing the liquid back up the straw and enabling you to drink. And you feel it very much, of course, if you dive into the water. Every 10 metres you go down in the water, another atmosphere's weight is acting on you. Luckily, there's 10 tonnes per square metre in our lungs pressing back, so we don't sort of feel it. But take a little bit of it away, and it's, well, catastrophic.
I'm quite intrigued by the sort of philosophical question that you raised earlier on about whether if there's no one to observe nothing, whether it's still nothing. It's a bit like the kind of does a tree falling in the woods make a sound if there's no one there to hear it? How old were you at the time? You must have been quite advanced.
No, I was very young. In fact, I was fascinated. Put it like this. Each of you listening to this, where were you 2 years before you were born? If you can start getting to grips with the idea of that, you begin to get a sense of this frightening aspect of what nothing really is. Where will you be after you've died? Well, people have their own ideas about that. But where we were 2 years before we were born, that is as nothing as I can imagine. Now, when you remove everything from the universe, have you thrown the container out as well? Or have you just emptied the container? That's the philosophical question.
Nell, you've got a question?
I wondered if you could explain, sometimes come across the idea that even in a complete vacuum, you have particles because they kind of appear and disappear in this sort of popping in and out of existence. And I wondered if you could sort of explain that or give me a metaphor that helps.
The Greeks and the ancients thought that once you removed all the air, there was literally nothing. Today, we know the universe is a much more weird place than they ever knew. In particular, like you say, there's this strange quantum that seems to rule everything. What we call the vacuum is full of stuff. It's an infinitely deep sea of little particles popping into and out of existence faster than you can know. And yet, we can tell that that is how it is. You can do experiments which reveal it is indeed like that. So the vacuum is far from empty in modern science. In fact, the vacuum is a medium that is full of stuff.
So is there anything that is actually empty if the vacuum isn't empty any longer?
Apart from my thought processes at the moment, probably not. That was my witty answer.
That's okay, that's fine.
Well, I actually wanted to ask about this ultimate free lunch that that Hawking talks about in The Brief History of Time. You know, this idea that the universe appears from nothing, apparently. I mean, do we know anything about what happened before the Big Bang?
Questions like what happened before the Big Bang, what happened before the start of time, is a moot point whether those questions are really even meaningful. You know, if time began at the Big Bang, what happened before? It's really a statement of our inability to imagine things like that. And the idea of the universe as the ultimate free lunch really is coming to grips with the ultimate paradox that's always been around is where did everything come from? I mean, when I say, where were you 2 years before you were born? You know, where did our consciousness come from? But at least the stuff that makes each of us has been around for billions of years. The atoms have always been around, you know, 5 billion years or more. It happens that for a brief time they collected together in a group which thinks that it's me or thinks that it's you, but those atoms have been around. They're just reformulated in a particular way. This paradox of, you know, what happened before it all began. Well, one thing we do know today is this idea of the quantum. And the bottom line of quantum mechanics is that you can borrow energy for a short amount of time, as long as you don't borrow too much. It turns out that the amount of energy in the universe could be nothing, which might sound surprising, but that is indeed possible. And that would mean that quantum mechanics allows you to borrow nothing for an infinite amount of time. So the idea that the universe...
Sounds like Northern Rock.
That's maybe where it's heading. And the idea that the universe could have erupted as a, quote, quantum fluctuation out of nothing for 14 billion years so far is completely okay with regards to modern science. The problem for me... And I'm sure, if we're all honest, the problem for everybody out there at this moment is, what's this guy talking about? The problem for me is, yes, but how, who, what said, let there be quantum, so that a universe could erupt out of nowhere? My feeling is that we are putting ever more sophisticated words to describe, ultimately, ignorance. It is impossible, for me at least, really to comprehend where things ultimately came from.
Well, thanks very much, Frank. More from Frank later in the show. But if you want to know more about nothing, The Void is published by Oxford University Press, and it's out now.
Hi, folks. This is Brian May. You're listening to Science Weekly on Guardian Unlimited.
Now, those of you old enough to remember the Guardian newspaper when it was the size of a double-decker bus may recall our weekly science supplement called Life and the much-lamented Far Out column. It featured those weird and wonderful tales from the fringes of science, you know, perpetual motion machines, flying saucers, invisibility cloaks, that kind of thing. Ideas that nearly made it into the mainstream, and those that were frankly best forgotten. Well, Mark Pilkington wrote that column, and he's just compiled the very best tales into a new book called Far Out, 101 Strange Tales from Science's Outer Edge. Well, thanks very much again for coming in, Mark. Now, one that really caught my eye was the Type 1 psionics machine. Yeah. This was crazy.
Better known as the Hieronymus device, which was not really a device, just a blueprint printed onto the pages of Astounding Science Fiction magazine. And it was enough just to cut out this blueprint and look at it and think about it for it to start working. You didn't actually need to build.
What was it supposed to do?
Pretty much anything. It would, what it would do would detect eloptic radiation, which is a form of energy emitted by everything in our material world, and could be then tuned into by the human operator of the device, who could use it to detect objects at remote distances, heal people, presumably make people ill. The inventor, Mr. Hieronymus, was able to make plants live, kind of blossom and grow in darkened rooms merely by transmitting eloptic energy at them through the walls. And this actually is very close to a field called radionics, which is still popular today, where you could, for example, put a sample of a pest like an aphid into the device, then a photograph of say your garden or a field, and then sort of focus your energy and destroy the aphids in the field. And this was actually investigated quite seriously in the 50s by the American, I think it was Kansas, by the Agricultural Board of Kansas, who did all sorts of experiments trying to eradicate kind of locusts and other pests from their wheat fields or cotton fields.
Well, I think we should look out for the Hieronymus device on pseudoscience blogs the world over. It could soon be back.
Yeah,
maybe it already is.
Maybe we started
The blueprint's in the book, so anyone who wants the book also gets a free psionics device with it.
But you also talk about Wegener's continental drift at one point, and I think you describe it as, you know, the only idea last century that really came from the fringes of science into the mainstream. But don't all new scientific ideas start on the fringes and then come into the mainstream? Is it really that different?
I'm not a scientist. I should say this up front. I'm an interested layman. But the sense I have is that there's a certain lack of adventurousness and boldness in sort of mainstream science these days, possibly because the way science is funded and organized and structured within society, partly because, tragically, most people, you know, think science is not actually that exciting anymore. So they see what might be seen as outrageous or wild ideas. They won't even put them forward because they're afraid of being ridiculed.
Frank, what do you think of that point as a man who's at the coalface? I mean, you know, was there a time when, you know, the sort of gentleman scientist was free because of, an independent income to be able to do effectively what he liked in Victorian times or something and think whatever thoughts he liked, whereas these days with funding bodies and targets and, all sorts of mechanisms to make sure that you're producing, is it a bit different from that now?
Well, I'm happy to confess that I am old enough to remember the days when The Guardian was a really big newspaper, but thankfully not so old that I was around in the days of the gentleman scientist. But your point is a good one. I mean, the problem today is you've got to get funding from somewhere to do especially big science. And the catch-22 is that if you haven't got a clue as to what might come out of what you're doing, it is very hard to convince somebody to fund you to do it. On the other hand, if you have got a pretty good idea, so they're happy to fund you, what's the point of doing it anyway? And so there is that sort of dilemma always. It is a big risk to put your career on the line in the hope. It's like, you know, gambling in that level. There are things that you can do which are fairly safe and you'll make some guaranteed progress with. But to have that risk of I'm going to put the whole career on the line to try to pursue this particular line, it's a brave or foolish, and it's only afterwards that you determine which it is.
Nell, you've got a question for Mark.
Mine was actually going to be a flippant reference to the sea monkeys you mentioned at the beginning.
Well, that was...
I just wondered, because you mentioned the aquatic ape hypothesis,
isn't it? Yeah, that was a poor joke about that.
I just wondered if you knew where it's at the moment. Well, what's the latest?
Elaine Morgan's still alive, and she's still putting...
The author of the kind of hypothesis.
She's not quite the
She took it on, didn't she?
Alistair Hardy, who was a marine biologist and sort of very respected at his time, presented the idea of Homo aquaticus to the British Sub-Aqua Club in 1960 and followed it up with several New Scientist articles. And he'd first thought about this in the 20s, actually, watching sea mammals being dismembered, and thought, well, you know, how did these mammals become sea creatures? And the idea was that early hominids spent a lot of time rooting around on the shores of the oceans when they were on four legs and would go into the water, kind of swim around, pick up food and clams and things, open them up, and eventually they started to get upright because the water was keeping them bobbing around, and they developed sensitive fingertips and things for rooting around in the on the seabed. And then eventually started to lose their hair because, you know, they didn't need it to be streamlined for swimming. And so this is sort of how the theory evolved. Unfortunately, of course, you look at, say, seals and sea otters.
Other hairy sea creatures.
There are plenty of hairy sea creatures. So there are a lot of problems with the hypothesis. But it's still extremely popular. And actually, when I wrote about this in the Far Out column, whenever it was, I had quite a few people writing in. There was some guy making a BBC radio documentary all about the hypothesis who actually refused to accept that it wasn't, you know, it didn't make sense, that it couldn't be supported.
So it still has its advocates out there?
Yeah.
And what do you think?
I think it's a beautiful idea, but I do think that, you know, the evidence doesn't really support the theory. But, science should be about beautiful ideas, and then you whittle the way, you know, the fun stuff until you get to the facts.
But okay, I think we should move on. Thanks very much, Mark. Far Out, 101 Strange Tales from Science's Outer Edge is out now, just in time for Christmas. I'm James Randerson, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come,
the crew has a traditional breakfast together, big steak or ham and eggs or whatever.
Never go to space on an empty stomach. Our man Ian Sample reports from Cape Canaveral and the launch of the European Space Lab. Plus, no, I haven't seen her in a while either. Down, girl. We reveal how dogs can handle abstract thought. First, though, here's a look at the rest of the science and tech news that's been making the headlines over the past 7 days.
News Jack.
The government's chief scientific advisor criticised the BBC's Today programme and the Daily Mail last week over what he called their campaigns against GM food and the MMR vaccine. Sir David King said Britain's failure to adopt GM crops had cost the economy between £2 and £4 billion, and that falling measles vaccination rates as a result of negative publicity about MMR would lead to between 50 and 100 child deaths.
China's trip to the moon may not have been all it seemed. Images supposedly taken by the Chang'e 1 probe were being scrutinised by bloggers within hours of appearing online. The bloggers claimed that uncanny similarities between previously taken NASA photographs meant that the Chinese had tried to fake the mission.
Chimpanzees have an extraordinary photographic memory that is far superior to our own, according to new research by Japanese scientists. The young chimps outperformed university students in memory tests, which involved remembering sequences of numbers on a screen.
And this week's second Animals Do the Most Amazing Things story involved man's best friend. Dogs have joined a select club of species that scientists have shown are capable of using abstract concepts. In a series of tests, the dogs were able to correctly categorise pictures that contain dogs as different from images of landscapes.
Thank you, Mark and Nell. OK, well, let's pick up on a few of them. Now, Sir David King was talking to a group of MPs earlier last week. And, I mean, it was a journalist's delight, really, because he pretty much, I mean, he's on his way out. So he's leaving the post at the end of the year. And so he had a go at pretty much everyone. He had a go at homeopathy, had a go at the Department of Health for licensing homeopathic medicines. He also had a go at the Department of Health for responding to a report by the Science and Technology Committee on abortion in a way that was, he said, embarrassing. He also said that Number 10 had tried to gag him when he made that famous statement about climate change being as dangerous as global terrorism. And he also said that the Purbright lab where the foot and mouth outbreak came from should have been closed down. So there were sort of eight stories in one there from one speech. But his attacks on the media here about MMR and GM are sort of, it's the sort of thing lots of scientists have been saying. Is that something that sort of hit your radar, Frank?
I sort of find it ironic that I'm here in a studio in The Guardian hoping to escape in one piece afterwards, being asked to make comments about how the media, I should actually be asking you this. As a media expert, What do you think is the reason that the public are prepared to put their kids at risk rather than to give them jabs, whereas the scientists have done, as far as I can tell, I'm not in that area of science, but my understanding is that the full set of scientific experiments, the best statistical evidence that you have, show clearly that MMR jabs create the potential for safety, and the absence of them, far from just affecting your particular child, can have a dramatic effect, even leading to death. Indeed, the figures that he was quoting there are very serious. So I should be asking you, what do you as a media expert feel is the reason that the public don't trust? What is the reason for this?
I think part of the problem is, I mean, I kind of agree with Sir David's position, actually, that, I mean, even now the Daily Mail has a position that is rather sceptical to MMR. And, you know, as you say, all the big epidemiological studies say that there is no link between MMR and autism. But I think that because that seed was planted in the public's mind, and people feel, well, you know, there is an alternative. I can get individual ones. I don't know. I do find it very strange, I must say. Now,
I was going to ask, why do you think he's had to wait until he's just about to go? I mean,
I guess he didn't want to rock the boat beforehand. I don't know. I'd be very interested to ask him, actually. But, you know, it's amazing that he sort of let off about so many people in this particular one. Intriguingly, one of the MPs said, "Is this your final battle?" referring to GM, because previously the week before he'd also made another speech saying that we need to adopt GM because it will bring us our third green revolution and will enable us to feed the planet despite climate change happening. And in response to that, he said, no, it's my penultimate battle, which made me very intrigued as to what else is coming. But I don't know.
Do you believe in climate change? You know, this is the other question on this as well. To be a practical scientist means you have to be sceptical. If you're not sceptical, you can't make progress. And with regard to climate change, I have a slight nervousness at the speed with which I get the impression that many people are now jumping on the bandwagon, so much so that there could be a sort of backlash against it. Phrases like, number 10 tried to gag, at least that's how you quoted.
That was me paraphrasing, but yeah.
But this just generates mistrust and uncertainty.
Mark, what do you think about the GM issue?
I think the issue really is one of transparency, and people don't, you know, it's a state of the world we live in now. It's a fact of the world we live in now that people don't trust government in any form, and there is a sense that they haven't been honest with things that have been going on, particularly with, say, GM trials, where, you know, they were a little sneaky about the way that was carried out, as far as I remember. Last year, actually, I was actually hired to be part of a Greenpeace project to identify one of three fields that were in France that were doing very secretive GM trials, and the French government would not admit this and make this public. And I used to be part of a team that made crop circles for some years, and we got hired by by Greenpeace to go and make something in one of these fields. And the police response was absolutely incredible. We snuck out under, it was a thunderstorm while we made it, we snuck out afterwards. The Greenpeace guys went in, they were held for questioning for something like 36 hours and were treated quite roughly by the government and the police.
Do you mean that those corn circles aren't aliens?
So, yeah.
You learn amazing things in these.
But, I mean, the you know, this was in France, but, you know, and that was an extreme example, but I think the idea is that people just don't believe everything they hear, whether it's about science or politics.
Maybe this is a hangover from BSE or something
like
that.
Exactly.
I must bring you in, though, on the animals. We're not as clever as we thought.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of my sort of personal favourites of soapbox subjects, is that increasingly we're having to accept that species other than ourselves are capable of complex thinking, abstract thought, and that whether it's slime moulds that can navigate mazes in search of food, or you know, dogs, which it doesn't take a scientist to tell you that dogs are very smart, you know, and can do amazing things, you know, whether it's following their owners across country after they've moved house, which dogs and cats, you know, recorded traveling hundreds of miles to do this. So I think it's what used to be called as the great chain of being, you know, that we're all basically part of this amazing ecosystem, that we're not unique.
Maybe it's not such a bad thing if we're brought down a peg or two. Well, if you've got any comments, and or even if you're a dog or a slime mold and you'd like to comment on these things, then head to the blog. It's at blogs.guardian.co.uk/science.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Au contraire, it was neither a case of one small step for a man nor a giant leap for mankind last week. After much fanfare, the planned launch of Europe's orbiting space lab aboard the space shuttle Atlantis was postponed. Mission officials believe dodgy wiring between the main fuel tank and the orbiter were to blame. At the time of podding, the mission to deliver the European Space Agency's long-delayed Columbus Space Lab was still stuck on the ground in Cape Canaveral. Our reporter Ian Sample went behind the scenes before the planned launch last Thursday.
I'm standing on launch pad 39A at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Around me, 140,000 acres of swampland, a few buildings, and a gleaming space shuttle Atlantis. Earlier, I asked Alan Thurkettle, the European Space Agency's programme manager for the space station, about the significance of the mission.
It gives us the opportunity to perform world-class science in a number of different domains, to perform technological research. It gives us opportunities for our astronauts to be on board. Every other year, we should have a European astronaut up on board for about 6 months at a time.
So how's your job going to change now that once this cornerstone of Europe's contribution to the space station is put in place?
We're at the end of the beginning. We're now starting to do the real program. We have to operate it. And generally trying to make sure that we get good enough results coming out of this, that the user community is happy, the funding community is happy, all of the different stakeholders. We now expect to be able to go along to them and say, look, you see, you were wise, you did the right things.
Looking forward to the launch?
Oh, are you kidding?
Before the flight, the crew are kept in quarantine, not least to make sure they don't pick up any colds or other bugs before going up into orbit. I spoke to former ESA astronaut and shuttle veteran Thomas Reiter about what the crew will be doing to prepare themselves for the mission.
They are still in crew quarters. They have a last chance to see their families. It's called Wave Across the Ditch. They can stand on one side of a trench and all their friends and relatives on the other side, and they can talk to each other, but they are not allowed to get much closer.
What did they actually do in this time they're in quarantine waiting to go up?
The morning before launch, the crew has a traditional breakfast together, big steak or ham and eggs or whatever. And then basically they need to get dressed up and get to the launch site approximately 4.5 hours before takeoff.
Now, the man in charge of ensuring a smooth launch for Columbus is NASA's Doug Lyons.
We start early in the morning, about 9 or 10 hours prior to launch, and we'll decide whether we should go into tanking or not. When we load our external tank, okay. And we load that with liquid oxygen, sure. And liquid hydrogen. And we'll also look at the weather and make sure the weather is acceptable. And so at that point, we make the decision to go ahead and deploy them from the crew quarters to the pad. And we have 7 people out there called the closeout crew, and they help and assist the crew into the vehicle. And the crew is actually strapped in to handle the forces while they're going uphill.
How's things looking so far for tomorrow?
It looks real good. The weather is very, very favorable. The outlook at this point is outstanding.
Famous last words. Ian Sample there, and truly we are sorry that we could not bring you a sound effect like this. Anyone in the pod, does Europe really need a space lab? Does the ISS have a future? We've spent an awful lot of money on this thing. Is it gonna yield some decent benefits, Frank?
Well, why should things change? As a scientist, if you ask the average scientist what science has come out of the International Space Station, the amount of money that's been spent on it, the answer is very little, if anything. And I think that is one of the reasons why there has been so much sort of knee-jerk prejudice among the scientific community against the idea of getting involved in human space exploration. Because there's been so much money wasted on military adventurism and political posturing to date, doesn't, to my mind, mean that there are not things that human space exploration could do that robots would not be able to do.
Martin Rees, head of the Royal Society, is very pleased that Britain didn't get involved and spend loads of cash on the ISS.
Yes, I wouldn't dispute that either myself.
Nell?
While there are all these fascinating discussions to be had and, you know, exciting progress and stuff going on in Cape Canaveral, turns out actually that, as far as we're concerned, the most important thing was a 7-year-old story about having sex in space.
Yes.
According
yeah, this
to
was utterly bizarre, wasn't
this
it?
Week.
Yeah, where did how did this happen? Strangely, it was the most popular story on the site, and it was written in 2000. It makes you wonder why we need to actually do any news journalism.
Do any news journalism at all? It was someone added it to their Dig account, and it was promptly picked up on, despite the fact that it was a story published in 2000. That was in itself based on an early internet hoax of a document and about positions in space.
Indeed. Well, just to recap, it was apparently a book by a French astronomy writer called Pierre Kohler, and he was talking about a secret shuttle mission in 1996 that tried out 10 different sexual positions to try and work out which ones you could do in space, but it was absolute nonsense, Frank.
Well, you've actually answered the question. I was beginning to feel out of it. I'd missed this one and was wondering how. So something scientific might have come out of the space station then if that had happened, but it didn't. So
unfortunately, it was all
speculation about the various partners that have gone up.
Yeah, well,
there
is.
There was a married partner. Two married astronauts went up, which they weren't normally allowed to do, but they got married so close to the launch date that it was decided to send them up anyway. But they've been very reticent about any possible experimentation.
I think we should leave that there. But next week, we'll discuss re-entry. OK, Frank, let's return to you before we wrap up. Now, your book after the next one is going to be about creationism. Where are you going with that one?
Well, the book immediately coming along before that will be about antimatter, which I'm hoping to get out before the movie of Angels and Demons comes out, which has got two great statements in that book, I'm told. One is there is indeed a laboratory called CERN, and two, they make antimatter there, and the rest of it is fictional. I've been actually let off the immediate hook because I'm told the Hollywood scriptwriters are on strike, so I've got a little bit longer to complete that than I thought. But after that, yes, you're right. I'm interested in the idea of pursuing what I call a book on creationisms. I mean, as we said earlier about the void, the great paradox is where did everything come from? And every culture in history has had an explanation of it. And the current one, which science, the scientific method contests, is that the universe began about 14 billion years ago. And of course, there are creationists who have reinvented themselves as intelligent designers or whatever the current phrase is, who have a somewhat different perception on this, the idea that the universe began in 4004 BC on a Thursday afternoon at 2:30. And, of course, they have lovely fights with the biologists claiming that Darwin's theory is only a theory of evolution. And I began to think, well, look, physics should take these people on because we know, without going into biology and evolution, we have good evidence that the universe is older than at least 6,000 years. Maybe. I say maybe because it reminded me when I was at university, the first time ever I met a person who believed these sort of things. And I managed to convince him that we could show that the universe is older than more than 6,000 years. At the end of this, he said, yes, but what you don't realise, Frank, is that the universe was made 6,000 years ago with an inbuilt memory to give the impression gosh. It was 14 billion years ago.
You just can't win, can you? Well, at least Richard Dawkins knows that the cavalry are riding in. And just finally, we've teased the audience for too long. What are the cosmic onions?
That was the idiom that you peel the layers away to get deep to the heart of the onion. It was my metaphor for how the universe is, how matter is made. And I didn't realise 25 years ago that I'd coined a phrase which would gain a life of its own.
Well, you heard it here 25 years late. OK, that's it from us. And sadly, I'll be handing back the presenter's chair to Alok next week because I'm off to Lapland to see Santa, watch the Northern Lights and talk to some climate change researchers. My thanks to everyone else in the pod, Nell Bowes, Mark Pilkington and, of course, our special guest, Frank Close. Now, we put all the details about both those books on the blog and on Facebook. But for now, let me leave you with the facts. Science Weekly is produced by Ben Green. I've been James Randerson, and it's been emotional.
Guardian Unlimited.